Welcome to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where national experts bring you facts and answers. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev, an emergency and addiction doctor who has served at the White House and practiced on the front lines. Right here on High Truths, you will learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs and addiction. High Truths is more than a podcast. It's a movement to unite physical, mental, and addiction health. It brings innovations to connect public health, public safety, and prevention. Our discussions inspire people to implement programs that save lives. To grow this community of information and action, I hope you give us a 5-star review. Come visit me on hightruths.com. Today's episode is sponsored by Drug Free America Foundation, tackling the pervasive issue of substance use and its far-reaching impacts on individuals, families, and community. Drug Free America is supporting ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis, doctors and scientists educating on the harms of marijuana. Hello again, High Truth listeners. Get ready for an Olympic conversation. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. Olympic, as in the world's foremost international sporting competition representing over 200 states and territories. The ancient Olympic Games were held in Greece since the 8th century BC, and the modern Olympic Games started in 1894, also in Greece. And with high-stakes competition comes cheating. And most of the cheating is due to doping or drugs. From November 1905 to November 2024, a total of 162 medals have been stripped due to cheating. Russia has had the most stripped medals. Testosterone and steroids are implicated drugs, but there are many other drugs associated with cheating. The recent headlines involved this cheating scandal with 23 Chinese swimmers who tested positive for banned performance-enhancing drugs on two occasions before the 2021 Games. The athletes were cleared from any wrongdoing, and the conclusion was that the trimetoxazine heart medication and the methandinone, a banned anabolic steroid, came from contaminated hotel food. Who knew hotel food can be poisoned with heart medication and steroids? Congress passed Anti-Doping Act by President Trump in 2020. Congress granted ONDCP, the White House Office of National Drug Control Policy, authority to withhold payment to WADA, the World Anti-Doping Agency, in the event that they did not act in a fair or effective and transparent manner. And that happened. Most recently, in January 8, 2025, ONDCP under President Biden announced that they will not pay the 2024 $3.6 million dues to WADA after the agency refused an independent audit for transparency and accountability to protect athletes. To learn more about Olympic doping, I reached out to Allison Wagner and Dr. Matthew Fedoric. Allison Wagner is a silver medalist swimmer at the 1996 Olympic Games in Atlanta. She is a victim of doping, as she was beaten in major competitions by swimmers who were later found to be using banned substances. Despite the cheating, she enjoyed a decorated swimming career and held the world record in the 200 IM for almost 15 years. Retired from swimming, she now works at the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, USADA, and as the Director of Athlete and International Relations. In this role, Wagner oversees Olympic, Paralympic, Pan-American, and Pan-American athlete engagement efforts that help USADA serve athletes. Dr. Matthew Fedoric currently serves as the Chief Science Officer, leading the science and research team at the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency. Dr. Fedoric is an expert at the scientific aspects of anti-doping. He has a PhD in pathology and laboratory medicine and serves on several committees for the World Anti-Doping Agency. To learn more about Allison Wagner, Dr. Matthew Fedoric, and the U.S. Anti-Doping Agency, check out the High Truth show notes. I recorded this conversation with Allison and Matt on February 7, 2025. Allison Wagner and Dr. Matt Fedoric, welcome to High Truths.
Thanks so much for having us, Renee.
Yeah, thank you.
No, it's a pleasure, and I can't, I've been waiting for this podcast, and it's the first time we have talking about Olympics on a drug podcast. Like, what's the connection there? And we're going to make that connection in our discussion. But Allison, let's start with you. You're a retired athlete, decorated swimmer. What are you doing now with USADA, the United States Anti-Doping Agency?
Yeah, so I'm the Director of Athlete and International Relations at USADA. I've been here for about 4 years. I was an Olympic swimmer, world champion and world record holder. And unfortunately, I won multiple silver medals at top level competitions to athletes who were later proven to have doped. So I understand from a personal level how that impacts athletes. And I'm working at USADA along with my colleagues like Matt to ensure that that doesn't happen to athletes now and in the future.
Interesting. And Matt, what about you? You work in pathology and lab, and how's that connected?
Yeah, great. Thanks for having us, Ronit. Pleasure to be here and talk science. I'm kind of USADA's in-house Bill Nye, the science guy. So really pleased to be able to shed some light and clarity on how science is connected to the drug testing that we do and how it plays out on the world stage. I have a PhD in pathology and lab medicine, and I got my start as a molecular biologist and transitioned into anti-doping somewhat serendipitously. I was working for a small biotech company and wanted to try to figure out how I could mold my love of sport. I grew up as a downhill ski racer in Canada and achieved pretty high success there, but chose to go down the school route rather than to stop and put full time into ski racing. So I wanted to take my love of science and sport, and I was fortunate enough to get a World Anti-Doping Agency funded grant, and I worked as a postdoc on that for a couple of years. And it just so happened that the Olympics was awarded to Vancouver, and they needed somebody to work with the Montreal Anti-Doping Laboratory to actually build a lab in Vancouver for the period of the games to test athlete urine and blood samples. And so I took that job on for over 3 years, and it was a fantastic experience and kind of a bit of trial by fire to learn all about anti-doping and how science impacts that in such a huge way. And as Allison alluded to, it really has the potential to really impact athletes as well. So hope to share a bit about that today on your podcast.
So what is the relationship between athletes and USADA? I mean, USADA is testing people for drugs, and I'm wondering if the relationship between the athletes and the drug testing is it hostile? They'll say, oh, those are the doping people, or is it a, or do they want that to keep things fair, or what is that relationship?
Yeah, we at USADA are all working to serve athletes and athletes' right to a level playing field. We do conduct tests and competition and out of competition. We weigh in as one of many global stakeholders on the global rules, the World Anti-Doping Code and standards, and we implement those rules in the U.S. And as one of the leading NADAs, I'm proud to say in the world in terms of advocating for athletes' rights. This is a really important part of my job and listening to athletes and how they feel the system is working and not working, and taking that feedback not only back to USADA, but also to the world system and the World Anti-Doping Agency.
Interesting. And Matt, you wanted to add?
Yeah, I think athletes give up a lot of their rights and privacy to be part of a robust anti-doping program. We ask a lot of them from regard anything from showing up at their homes at all hours to collect samples to, attending, sitting in the back of classrooms or at work, or even accompanying them to the airport in order to make sure that we can collect a sample from them. They also have to file whereabouts information so we can actually plan testing. So we recognize that it's a huge burden, but I think we're really proud of the work that we do to make sure that we explain to athletes how the system works for them, how it protects them. And I think for many of them, it's a badge of honor to be part of the USADA testing program. We spend a lot of time trying to educate them and are serious about incorporating their feedback into rule changes and making sure that, you know, we want them to focus on their training and competition and being the highest performing athletes as possible. And fortunately or unfortunately, anti-doping is a small part of that job, but we want to make it as athlete friendly as possible. And I think over the years, we've developed a really great relationship with athletes around the United States and globally as an agency that listens and are able to take feedback into account in designing the best possible anti-doping programs that exist.
And you're the Olympics. You're like, you know, the gold star of all sporting events. Does what you do trickle down to NCAA sports and high school sports, et cetera?
Yeah, absolutely. So the USADA anti-doping rules, we're what's known as World Anti-Doping Agency Code compliance. So that means from a global sense, we follow the global anti-doping rule system. But anybody who is a member of a national sport governing body in the United States is essentially under the USADA anti-doping rules. So even though the focus is at the very elite level, and obviously if you're an elite level swimmer like Allison, she was subject to testing, you know, in and out of competition, but we also test at the youth level. We test developmental level athletes. Many of our athletes are also collegiate level athletes. So there's an overlap between college level sport and elite level national and international level sport, all the way through to our True Sport program, which aims to really develop the fairness and awareness of how to compete clean all the way from parents through to the youth sport level, coaches, as well as health professionals are a very big part of the work that we do to educate. So the athlete entourage, not only athletes, are very important to the whole anti-doping movement.
Interesting. Allison, let's come to you. You obviously had a swimming career. How did that start? Were you like this, like, five-year-old kid and your mom and dad are taking you to swim meets all over the place?
Yeah, pretty much. I, you know, grew up in a family whereby my parents insisted my brothers and I play a sport, and they didn't mind what sport, but I had three options and I wasn't very good at the other two. So I went with swimming and I took to it right away, and I loved to race anyways. So I stuck with swimming and loved it and moved around a lot because I was a military kid. So swimming was pretty convenient to help with those transitions. You know, there's always a swim team in every place that I moved to. So that was great. But I was very much, you know, and appreciative of the opportunity to better myself and also have an outlet for wanting to race. And there are a lot of sports that involve racing, but, you know, swimming's just one of them. And it was great for me. I found that outlet and I loved finding my confidence through physicality and sport too. That's really great, I find, in many sports across the Olympic and Paralympic movement, especially for young girls and women, to find that confidence in their bodies and find their ability to be competitive and embrace that part of themselves.
That's great. And I guess it's good if you are a military brat, you have instant friends in the different swim teams that you join.
Exactly.
Yeah. By the way, out of curiosity, what were the other two sports that you didn't like?
Softball and soccer.
Oh, balls. There we go.
Very different sport.
Right. So did you watch Olympics as a little girl and say, I want a gold medal?
Yeah. Well, I watched the Olympic Games and thought, wow, that would be really neat to be a part of. And the first time I remember watching the games was in 1988. And I watched Janet Evans, who's one of our country's best swimmers. And she was winning gold medals. And I thought, wow, that's so impressive. I wonder if I could make it to the Olympic Games one day. And 4 years later, at the age of 14, I jumped from being 71st in the country to fifth at the Olympic trials. And the top two go to the games. And I thought, wow, maybe this is possible. And step by step, I improved and made it to the games in 96.
Nice. How old were you?
18.
Oh, it's a little girl.
Yep.
Great. So you did it and you won silver. How did you feel? Were you happy or disappointed at that time when you actually got the medal?
Well, unfortunately, the woman who won gold, there was a lot of suspicion that was later validated about her doping. And she had, you know, dropped something like 25 seconds in a year in the event, came out of nowhere, body changed quite significantly, and a lot of signs of steroid use. So it was my fourth medal in a few years to an athlete who was either strongly suspected or later proven to have doped. So it was actually quite disappointing and defeating, because I value, just like a lot of Olympic and Paralympic athletes, I really value the pursuit of excellence with integrity. That's a really special part of the Olympic and Paralympic Games that a lot of athletes really value in their participation in this sphere of sport. And having that value of integrity and not seeing it honored or respected or protected by those people in positions of decision-making and power that could protect me, and them not doing their job, was really disappointing.
You got cheated.
Yeah.
Nobody wants to get cheated. But when you won that silver, did you know that? Did you know, like, oh, she won and she's a cheater?
Yeah.
You did. You kind of suspected it. And what country was she from?
Ireland.
And was there any consequences? Okay, so later, everybody's suspicious, okay? Like, she looks different. She cut out her time. Like, this does not look normal. Later, it's validated through testing. And what were the consequences?
Yeah, so Matt can shed a lot of light on this. And of course, I knew from an athlete side, you know, I had an experience of applying, of anti-doping rules being applied to me. But back then, the world anti-doping system was a little bit different. It was really up to the sport federation to apply rules. And it wasn't so harmonized as it is now or should be. You know, this last year, we learned that unfortunately, it's not as harmonized across borders as it should be still. But back then, it was even less harmonized. And she was later caught tampering with a sample, urine sample, and was banned from the sport and never competed again.
But you didn't get your gold. Did she get stripped from her medal?
No. So the IOC, the International Olympic Committee, will not review any medal reallocations prior to the year 2000. And that's a rule or decision they made. Not sure what the basis of that decision was.
Oh, so you got ripped off twice.
Yeah. So, you know, it's great fuel for me, because I would hate for any other athlete. And through this last year, seeing what's happened to swimmers in our country and other countries, it's been great motivation for me to, you know, push as hard as possible in collaboration with our colleagues, my colleagues at USADA, but also colleagues across the world, to ensure that this kind of thing is rectified, this kind of experience for athletes, and also to help people understand what's really at stake. You know, athletes' careers are at stake, and also well-being. You know, it's incredibly depressing for athletes to, you know, value that integrity and make all these sacrifices and comply with the anti-doping rules and show up at a competition and see that the rules aren't always applied to everybody else.
No, I mean, it's cheating, right? The same thing if it was a test, right? Or SAT or your MCAT scores are getting into med school. Everybody's cheating and you did it right and your scores are less. It's like, not fair. So if that competition was 2000 or later, would you have now have gotten your gold medal?
It's hard to say based on the details and evidence I'm aware of. I would think that it would be likely, but actually Matt is quite aware of this case. So I'd be curious to hear his opinion, but it really would have depended on how a hearing at CAS went. There was a hearing around her tampering of the sample. But yes, a lot of athletes, thankfully, maybe not a lot, but there are cases now where an athlete is reallocated their rightful medal. And that's something that we celebrate, but also recognize the tragedy in that. You know, one athlete we're aware of received his medal in an airport, just handed a box. You know, they miss out like I did, and those opportunities to receive that medal and recognition, but also career opportunities, you know, opportunities for sponsorship and prize money and things like that.
Yeah. So Matt, shed light on Allison's case. What's the scoop?
Yeah, no, I mean, a big part of anti-doping is not just the testing of samples, but as Allison alluded to, there's what we call non-analytical anti-doping rule violations. So this tampering case or cases such as the Russians being involved in the laboratory being involved in covering up positive samples, and investigations that occur because of that, things like attempting to, you know, conspire or aid athletes in doping, are ways that violations can be brought now. So the system compared to when Allison competed, I think, is a lot more robust in the way that it applies not only to athletes, but also athlete support personnel. So one could conceive that the people that assisted the athlete in tampering in Allison's case could even be removed from the sport now. So I think the system allows for much more accountability, and arguably it's better when coaches and others that are influencing athletes or multiple athletes or teams, officials, those doctors, those individuals that have such a huge influence on athletes can also now be held accountable. And certainly there's many cases and examples of that over the last number of years.
So what happened in Allison's case? The girl tested positive for steroids. She was suspected or caught tampering with her urine.
Allison, correct me if I'm wrong. It's I haven't spent a lot of time talking to you about this, but I believe the instance was related to concealing clean urine in her body in a condom, actually, and then providing that clean sample instead of her dirty sample that was still in her bladder.
That's so old school.
Yeah, pretty old school, but I believe that's the explanation in this instance.
And that was proven, and she got kicked out, but nothing, and that was it.
It was, yeah.
Did she still keep her medal?
Yes.
I'll have to defer to Allison on that. I'm not too sure.
And no, yeah. I'm like really shocked that no American lawyers didn't get involved in this and start some type of fight.
Well, as Allison said, the rules back then were the IOC ran the anti-doping programs at the Olympics, but it was really left up to the individual sports to police themselves. And as we well know, those sports are in the business of sport. And so in many instances, that wasn't done very effectively because of the bad press or the negative connotations of having Olympic champions or other elite athletes in those sports test positive. So I think having a truly independent program like we have today with USADA policing anti-doping is a much more effective model, and athletes can have a lot more confidence in that as well.
So Allison, what were you exposed to as far as testing? I mean, Matt was described like you have to say where you are and you get tested at the airport. And were you always on call to be tested, or how often were you drug tested?
Yeah, even back then I was tested out of competition and in competition often. I was also an NC2A athlete for a period of time. So I was tested not only by the International Federation for Swimming, but I was also tested by the NC2A. And then later—
Wait, tell us what that is, NC2A.
NC2A, the collegiate system. So they have another—
NCAA. There you go.
NCAA. Yes. Excuse me. If that's not, familiar. So I also swam later and was tested by USADA for a number of years. So I'm familiar with both systems, but honestly, I experienced them very similarly. Swimming was a bit different than some other sports back in the 90s. They had a bit of a better program. even before WADA was established. So I was tested often at home. Just like athletes today, you know, a doping control officer will show up at your house pretty much any time or training perhaps and say, you know, I need to collect a sample, urine and or blood sample from you. And as Matt stated earlier, there are many funny stories athletes have to report about how that goes. You know, it's always unfortunate when the doping control officer knocks on the door and you just use the restroom. So you're sitting there and having to hydrate and all of that. But yes, testing at all times and being aware of what you're consuming being careful about you know, all the details that are involved in complying with anti-doping.
Yeah. And you know what? Other professions, pilots and other professions are subject to the same thing, right? In addition to athletes. Okay. So Matt, let's learn a little bit more about the details of testing and or the whole drug problem. How big a problem is doping? How common is it?
Well, I think there's a gap between the prevalence and actually how many positive tests we may be finding. And we've done some research in that area. And certainly it varies from population to population and getting an accurate estimate of that. But we estimate somewhere between, you know, 2 and 9% in the United States. We did a survey about 4 years ago and published the findings and went through different substances on the prohibited list and asked athletes about their use. And so that was the first time that it happened in the United States with the elite athlete population. But we have large ranges up to, you know, high 30% range and even in some populations. So the testing is not the only component of anti-doping. It's one component. And I like to think of anti-doping not as just a detection program, but we're really trying to run an effective deterrence program. So that's where things like the education and prevention, educating athletes effectively, getting in front of them in person, building relationships with them, making them understand how to compete clean, how to make better choices, making sure we educate not just them, but their entourage as well, athlete whereabouts, communicating things like the positive tests on athletes has a huge impact from a deterrent standpoint. So public disclosure of the findings is a very important component of an effective anti-doping program. So it's a holistic approach, which has evolved over time to make sure that we have all the various tools in our toolbox to really run an effective deterrence program and testing. Without a testing component of that, there wouldn't be effective deterrence.
That's interesting. You know, I've talked on this show about employment drug testing, which is different. People have their privacy and get referred to treatment and get second chances. But the whole point is a deterrence program. Right? Like if you know you're going to be tested, you're going to be careful, right?
Absolutely. And so just the component of that testing is what's really important is that athletes, we conduct no advance notice testing. So the athlete doesn't know when the tester is going to show up. And that's really important from the standpoint of the substances that can be used to dope because they have different half-lives and they're excreted differently from our bodies. So being able to make sure that athletes can anticipate on how to game the system is a very important component.
Yeah. And my daughters are in the military and I know that they've been afraid to eat poppy seed bagels. And I actually did a whole podcast with an expert on that to be able to reassure them that they can have poppy seed bagels, that will not make them test positive.
And it's the prohibited list is very complex, and for an athlete to understand that we recognize is very challenging, and so we want to try to give them really helpful and accessible resources to be able to help navigate that. So one example of that is you saw it along with the Canadian anti-doping agency, the UK anti-doping and anti-doping Switzerland, have developed a searchable database for not only banned substances, but actually brands of medication. So any athlete or coach or pharmacist or doctor can use those things that help give a check mark or a big red X as to if those things are permissible in sport or not. So if you pull up the prohibited list as an athlete, I can really relate to the fact that it's just a mumbo jumbo of ingredients and chemical names that don't mean a lot. And so it's a really important component of our program to make sure that athletes don't get tripped up, that we give them the tools they need to make good decisions when they need to use drugs. And there are many reasons why an athlete may need to use a drug that's on the prohibited list.
Yeah. So you said that you did a study about, you know, the prevalence of drug use or positive tests. You said certain populations are more at risk. Can you mention that? Is that a certain sport is more at risk, or?
Yeah, we've certainly, the literature points to, there are certain high risk sports that we recognize that.
Wonder, wrestling?
Maybe more prevalent in their use. And so an example of that may be strength and power sports, where anabolic agents, which are still at the top of the positive test list from a prevalence standpoint, are more likely to be used than, say, in a more tactical sport where strength and power aren't as important. Endurance sports are another high risk category where athletes can use substances that enhance their oxygen carrying capacity, like EPO and blood doping. So those are sports that we that can have higher prevalence as well. And so the other angle is that, of course, we can't test all levels of sport at the same capacity. And so we've seen anecdotally that it's kind of sad to say, but at the master's level or at the recreational level of sport, we think there is a higher prevalence of doping, because some of those key components, due to financial and resource reasons, we can't apply those same level of testing and other components to those athletes. So making sure that the culture of sport is aware of the prevalence and what they do in order to set certain expectations or engage with USADA at certain levels. We've certainly seen in the last number of years the amount of education that we're doing, just forgo the testing, but just educating athletes at the recreational level has shot up dramatically. So that's a great thing, and just making them aware of the problem and is a real step in the right direction.
So as far as testing, you do blood and urine. What drugs? Do you have a set panel? And you have, you know, I'm an emergency physician, so my panel is like 10 drugs. It's very, very limited. I can't test for steroids like you do, and many of the drugs that you are testing for. But does everybody test for the same drugs all over the world?
Yeah, it's a great question. And many people think that anti-doping is kind of like a litmus test. It's a, you know, you dip a dipstick in and it's positive or negative, and nothing could be further from the truth. We're looking for hundreds of prohibited substances and their metabolites in urine and blood samples. And the list is very diverse in its chemical makeup. We look for everything from anabolic agents to peptide hormones to diuretics to beta-2 agonists from asthma inhalers to stimulants, narcotics, glucocorticoids, cannabinoids, and hormone and metabolic modulators, as well as for things like that are the result of blood manipulation, such as transfusions and those kinds of things. So you can imagine that when a sample arrives at the laboratory, there's many, many different tests that need to be applied in order to detect these wide range of substances. And that's what makes it so complex and expensive And many substances that are becoming more popular, I get the question all the time, well, what keeps you up at night? And the substances that keep me up at night are those ones that our bodies produce naturally, but there's synthetic versions of those chemicals that can be taken as drugs that aim to boost the effects of those hormones.
Such as what?
Yeah, so examples are things like testosterone, erythropoietin, which is a blood boosting substance that is produced naturally by our kidneys. But
you would know that somebody took it falsely based on the level, right?
Not for those substances. We need to be better than that. So because there's such a wide variability in the athlete population, we're taking a much more, there's two ways. Essentially, you need to be able to differentiate between a synthetic version and the natural version. Or we also have implemented something called the athlete biological passport. And this is where a much more forensic approach to anti-doping has evolved, where we're actually collecting serial samples on an athlete over time and then looking at variability in biomarkers that could give us an indication of whether those changes in an athlete's physiology are due to doping or just natural variability in the body. So it's become very, very sophisticated. Wow. We get a lot of information from every sample that we collect, and then we're analyzing that and interpreting that in order to assess whether there's a presence of a prohibited substance, or we could actually bring a violation based on indirect marker abnormalities through the athlete biological passport. And certainly that's been quite successful in some of the endurance sports where we see huge changes in athletes' hemoglobin levels or other markers that are indicative of doping and can't be the result of normal physiological changes.
So you're keeping samples for years. You're testing really complex chemicals. This must be the most expensive lab in the world.
Well, there are only 30 laboratories around the world that are accredited to do this work. So the typical clinical laboratory that you collect samples at a doctor's office and send them off to are not the laboratories that are used. It's much more sophisticated and requires a level of sensitivity that is many magnitudes better than what some laboratories use in the clinical space. So you can imagine that these are extremely well-developed laboratories. They have a ton of expertise in specific methodology, and they're always trying to hone in on new substances and threats that emerge from the world of doping. And those are almost endless when we see new drugs being developed or things becoming available on the black market. It's a rat race from the standpoint of...
It sounds similar to the illicit drug market where there's whack-a-mole. Absolutely. We figure out one and then there's another one comes up, you know, and you have that in your world for performance enhancing.
Yes.
So these 30 labs around the world, are American samples going to different ones? Are we sharing? I mean, I'm sure some of the poorer countries.
Yeah. So we're fortunate that in the US we have two WADA accredited labs in the United States. We don't run the laboratories as USADA. They're independent laboratories. So one's at UCLA and the other one is in Salt Lake City. And both those labs emerged from the games in both of those locations. But they're the real experts. And we have laboratories in Montreal and Rio de Janeiro in the Americas. And then there are other laboratories spread out amongst the other continents around the world. So American athletes, the samples that we collect, many of them go to the laboratories in the US, but if an athlete is competing or training or living overseas and a tester shows up and collects a sample over there, then they can go to another laboratory. And this is where the harmonization is very important. We want to make sure we get the same answer from a testing of a sample, no matter which lab it goes to. And so that's a big part of the scientific process and the technical documents that exist that aim to harmonize the methodology and the sensitivity across the world.
Yeah. You mentioned cannabinoids. Marijuana is legal in many states in the United States. Contrary to popular thought, most people do not use drugs. Most people do not use marijuana, but there's a perception that it's very common and everywhere. How is marijuana treated in athletics?
Yeah, great question. So marijuana is prohibited only in competition, and it's what's known as a threshold substance. So if it's over a certain urinary concentration in a sample, that's when it can be declared as a positive. So it is permitted out of competition. But one of the challenges with using marijuana and cannabinoids is if you use them out of competition, you're still responsible for the presence of them that may exist when you compete. And this is where some of the challenges around the science lie with respect to urine testing, opposed to some of the other matrices that exist out there. And so one of the areas we've been advocating for at USADA is maybe to change the way that we test. If marijuana is going to remain on the list, then maybe there's a better way to really advance the in-competition detection window of it and narrow that window down to real in-competition use. And so that could be done through things like blood testing or oral fluid testing or dried blood spot testing. And so that's an active area of research and advocacy for us at USADA.
Yeah. And maybe, Allison, I don't know if this is a question for you, but what's the perception of marijuana in sports? I don't think it would be performance enhancing. It would probably be make your performance worse.
Yeah, we actually asked athletes in a survey we circulated a few years ago, and most athletes don't feel that cannabis is performance enhancing. And that's the consensus in science as well. But I think that, you know, some athletes would still like that substance prohibited in competition and maybe even out of competition. So when we run our next survey, it'd be really interesting to get some more feedback on that substance and how athletes view it.
Yeah.
Ronit, one of the interesting components of the world that we work in is that we work off a harmonized prohibited list, and that's the WADA prohibited list. And so WADA convenes a group of scientific and medical experts that review that list constantly and are making updates. And as a stakeholder in that, USADA, every year we have the opportunity to make sure that we can give feedback during the consultation period. And so we're advocating for changes or updates or even removals in some instances of substances as the science evolves and as our thinking and feedback from athletes evolves. But with regards to how a substance gets on the list, there's three criteria, and the prohibited list expert group determines if it meets two of those three criteria, then that is the threshold for including it. And so those criteria are, it enhances performance or has the potential to enhance performance. It can adversely affect the health of an athlete, and it's against the spirit of sport. And so there's a bit of subjectivity in that decision-making process, which I think makes it challenging with some substances to really determine with a fine line of where that inclusion versus exclusion decision should lie. And certainly it's an evolution in
I'll give you my two cents on the marijuana thing. First of all, your athletes are in that age where their brain is still growing, right? Allison, you got your medal when you were 18 years old. I'm sure you felt like an adult, but your brain was not done growing, right? Not till you're 25, 26, 27. So that age is of brain development extremely, regardless of whether it's performance enhancing or not, is susceptible to marijuana and other illicit drugs in terms of addiction. In terms of risk for psychosis, we've seen from Canadian studies with millions of people that the risk of psychosis between the ages of 12 and 19 for cannabis users, it can be up to 11 times higher than the general population. And I'll just share a story that we have some hockey teams in San Diego, and more than once I've been referred to by the coach with someone, a young athlete in training who's there with psychosis, and they're blown off. It's like, oh, it's just pot. But it's not just pot. Because if you're 19 years old and you have psychosis, if it's cannabis-induced psychosis and we explain to you what's happening to you, you could have a normal life. If we just blow it off and you think, oh, it's just weed, you could condemn that athlete, that, or it doesn't have to be an athlete, anyone, young person, to a lifelong struggle with mental illness. So I don't know. And yeah. You guys are, you're examples to young people around the world.
Absolutely. And my worry as a scientist is that the potency of formulations and products that are now available are totally different than even 10 years ago. And so when you're thinking about all the different routes of administration and the products available, it's really concerning because the dose effect of marijuana and cannabinoids is just has the potential to be so much higher than it was in the past.
Yeah. I took care of a football player who had a seizure, very violent one, on an airplane because of marijuana. And so it's not as benign a drug, whether it's performance enhancing or not. I think it would probably make you, like, you know, run or swim, not as good instead of better, but regardless, not good for you. Okay, if that's not controversial enough, let me ask you more. You know, especially it's on the news right now, men in sports, testing for testosterone, that's definitely performance enhancing. How do you manage transgender women with the fact that they're taking testosterone, or the other way around?
Yeah, great question. And we get so many questions around this and how it affects sport. So USADA is obviously in the business of making sure athletes aren't using prohibited substances. And so to the extent that there are medical conditions or trans in the instance of transgender athletes, medications that need to be used during that process, we handle that through the therapeutic use exemption process. And so that's a way to get permission to use those substances under the anti-doping rules. Where we're not responsible for, and it's a really important area and probably the most controversial area right now, is the eligibility of those athletes in sport and sport making decisions as to whether those athletes are eligible to compete and what categories that they compete in. And so that's a separate question that anti-doping rules don't address, but certainly the crossover is very important. And mainly, you mentioned one, testosterone, but there are instances of other medications. Spironolactone is the other medication used in cases of trans female athletes, and that is a substance that we sometimes see as well. So we handle that from a medical perspective in granting permission if it meets certain WADA TUE criteria. But the eligibility question, I think, is the one that's been more in the news lately, and certainly that has been handled in an evolving way and differently by many different sports bodies around the world. And so I think some of the news that you're seeing in the last couple of days speaks to the harmonization of that in decisions around whether certain transgender athletes can compete or not. And that extends not just to elite level sport, but down through recreational and youth level sport. And so it's a heated topic for sure.
So if the president, you know, makes his, you know, executive order, no men in women's sports, I always thought it should be an XX versus XY, you know, team, which is very clear cut. But does that affect USADA, and does it affect your decision making if the president makes an executive order?
I think, well, it does and it doesn't. So the eligibility part of it is not, as I mentioned, our decision, and that's more what the executive order directly addresses. However, I think from the standpoint of adhering to the World Anti-Doping Code and the international standards that are associated with that, and the need for harmonization around the world, and to the extent that certain populations of athletes may be impacted, the rules may impact them, we're still operating under the UNESCO convention that United States has signed on to, and the World Anti-Doping Code, and so we'll continue to operate under that, but appreciating that some different decisions are being made at the sport policy level that directly impact athletes and their actual ability to compete in sport. Those are probably where the major changes are happening.
But wouldn't it be a loophole if, because you say you're transgender, you're allowed to use testosterone?
It's not a loophole, because the transitioning process, we handle that strictly from the medical standpoint and the need for the prohibited substance. And so we use an independent body of physicians that are evaluating those applications in accordance with the WADA international standard for TUEs. And so it's handled more from the medical sense and demonstrating that you have the medical need. We're not making decisions on the eligibility side, which is the sport side of it.
But I think I had that discussion where you have that transition, you could use the drug, but actually in day of competition, you can't use.
Yeah, you could only use it if the therapeutic use exemption was approved by the TUE committee and granted by USADA or another international sport federation. And so that speaks to having permission to use the substance itself, because that substance is prohibited in sport. But whether you're actually able to compete or not is the decision making for the sport, not for USADA.
So that means swimmers and wrestlers may make different decisions?
The sport doesn't really come into it when it comes to the substance and the, you know, whether the athlete's granted a TUE or not. It's based on the medical condition and the need for the medical treatment. So those are evaluated in the sense of the sport of the athlete doesn't matter in that context.
Okay. Well, I think we've all seen on TV trans women who are like twice the size of a girl. I'm sure those, you know, I'm sure the girl who got the silver while the trans woman who's twice her size felt cheated, kind of like Allison did with the steroid case. Let's talk about more cheating. Chinese athletes tested positive for trimetazine, right? The cardiac medications, and methadone. I'm probably not saying it right, butchering the names, a steroid. Reading about the case, I like was laughing out loud when the excuse was that they found out in their food. Like, who finds cardiac medications and steroids in their hamburgers?
Yeah, great question. And certainly there has been instances of contamination of food around the world for different prohibited substances. So this is something we're acutely aware of, and for example, have advocated for and have rule changes around certain categories of substances like diuretics or growth promoters in meat, for example. And then we also warn athletes around the use of supplements, specifically because of the way that supplements are not regulated the same way drugs are. And so there can be contamination from dietary supplements. So we advocate for athletes to...
Is that a plausible explanation that you found heart medicines in the heart and the hamburger?
Yeah, so I was getting to the point that each case is very unique. And I think the facts of the case and the circumstances of the case have to be very thoroughly vetted and understood in order to make the correct scientific determination. And so that's what we aim to do in USADA. And certainly we've had some instances of eyebrow raising instances of athletes, you know, taking pet administering pet medication to their pet that then causes them to test positive, or sexual contamination cases. And so that's where the good science, the great science, the evidence-based research, really honing in on what the facts are and trying to determine the plausibility is so important. And so, and the transparency of that is very important as well.
I mean, when I read that, I thought, well, if it's true that the athletes didn't know that, maybe, I don't know, their coaches put it in their hamburgers.
That what, as far as I know, that wasn't okay. the explanation, but certainly, you know, it's really important. And I think Allison alluded to this earlier, that all anti-doping agencies around the world are holding ourselves to the same standard when it comes to investigating these cases, following the rules when it means, you know, some hard decisions around things like provisionally suspending athletes until the facts are all understood and laid out. And so that's what we expect as a leading anti-doping agency. And that's where some of the disagreements have occurred.
So did that happen in the Chinese case?
No. I mean, it's a big happening and devastating to a lot of athletes that this has happened, not only to the athletes that competed against some of these athletes that tested positive, but for everybody in the sport, swimming and in other sports. I mean, this is hugely disturbing because the evidence and the science and provided didn't really add up. And not only that, but the rules weren't. So Matt's mentioned the World Anti-Doping Code and standards. And just as a quick fun fact, there are 2,643 pages of rules, which is quite a big rule assortment. But, you know, the rules weren't applied as they should have been. And the World Anti-Doping Agency knew that and didn't enforce the compliance. So that's where it upsets athletes. Like, why weren't the rules applied? And also, and I can speak to personal experience, when you see what might be doping, we don't know for sure, but you think, wow, are those athletes being doped without their consent as well? Mm-hmm. And that's a whole nother issue. And, you know, I'm proud and being a swimmer, and the culture of swimming is very much focused on integrity and clean sports. But also, people really care about, you know, are those athletes being abused, essentially? Are they being mistreated? So, you know, the facts and details, as WADA's appointed investigator pointed out on this issue, they didn't really add up. And so that's what's disturbing to people, because the whole point of the system of rules under WADA is that they are applied evenly. And that's where athletes gain their confidence when they walk into a competition. They say there's a global rule system and all the rules are applied the same. And if they aren't, especially in a situation like this that involved elite level athletes at the top level of competition, Olympic Games, it's very disconcerting and concerning. And what comes out of it is what really matters. You know, how can the system be changed so that this never happens again? And athletes don't have to face the kind of consequences to their confidence, their well-being, their careers, and the sacrifices they've made in their young lives to represent their country.
Yeah. And there's a lot that happened because of that scandal, right? I heard FBI got into it. Michael Phelps, you know, star Olympic swimmer, testified in Congress. And funding from WADWA has now been withheld. The dues from the U.S. dues, $3.6 million, because, you know, the changes that you wanted to see didn't happen.
Yeah, so athletes' concerns were the same concerns in our government. and in many other countries, not only government representatives to WADA, but also other national anti-doping organization and other athletes and their representatives. So yeah, the concerns I outlined were the same concerns held by everybody across the world.
Right. And how have things changed since that? That was like, that was before Paris, that incident with the Chinese. How did the Paris Olympics, was there still cheating happening there? And what do you think things have been corrected for future games and competitions?
There was a significant impact on athletes' well-being and the way they viewed the playing field and whether or not it was level in Paris. And
for the good or for the bad?
For the worse.
Oh.
Yeah, no, I feel whenever you have something like this occur and the same thing happened in Russia, I experienced the same thing when there was systemic doping in the 90s. What happens is athletes just lose their confidence that the rules are being applied and enforced evenly. And so that affects, you know, your well-being. That's just what happens when you're making those kinds of sacrifices and you're letting the global anti-doping system know where you're sleeping every night and where you are every day so that you can submit a urine and blood sample every day. You expect that burden is proportionately recognized and served by those people in positions of power.
So Matt, have things changed within WADA? Is the leadership still, is the organization still led by the Chinese Communist Party? Have things been shaken around in there?
The leadership is still the same. The same president and director general are in place. At the operational level, USADA, you know, was quite heavily involved in the pre-games testing ahead of Paris. So there is a pretty extensive testing program that we, along with other expert colleagues, helped choreograph to make sure that athletes, as many athletes as possible, were robustly tested, not just US, but around the world ahead of Paris. And then I heard of a number of positives in Paris. And then, of course, they have the post game sample storage program. So those samples are all being stored for up to 10 years. And that has been quite instrumental in making sure that the new techniques that are developed can be applied to those stored samples on substances that were prohibited at that time. And many cases have evolved, not from Paris, but from previous games, that have resulted in reallocation of results and medals. And we just actually heard as a staff from one of those instances was Shannon Robury, who competed in London in the 1500 meters. We heard that she was recently awarded the bronze medal in that race after disqualification of three athletes ahead of her. So that was fantastic. And we hope she gets the recognition that she deserves from that.
Nice. It's nice to see wrongs being corrected. President Trump, follow him. He's really proud to have the Olympic Games come to L.A. in 2028. And now I learned that the lab is in L.A. So how convenient is that? Are you guys preparing already for that competition?
Absolutely. Yeah, we're super excited about L.A. and all the events like the FIFA World Cup and other international events coming to the United States. We hope to work with our international federation, and there's an international testing agency that is responsible for anti-doping programs on many of those programs, along with our colleagues at LA 2028, and in preparing for, you know, what we hope to be a pageantry of sport and the cleanest games ever. And we're building up the expertise and capacity in-house to be involved in that. And so that 4 years goes by very quickly. And I think we'll be at the 3-year mark within the next few months. And so we're deep into that planning process and engaging with those entities.
That's very exciting. And so in kind of wrapping up here, Allison, what is your message to young athletes?
Try a sport. And if you're already in a sport, you know, continue to pursue your self-improvement in whatever ways are fulfilling for you, but do it in a way that embraces your personal integrity and also demonstrates your respect for everybody else in your field.
Very nice. And Matt, what about you? What's your message to people in charge of athletic events?
Yeah, I think we still need to keep our foot on the gas pedal when it comes to making sure that the rules are evolving to keep up with the ever-evolving threats that the doping presents in sport, and making sure that we also innovate. And that's a big part of improving the experience for athletes in order to make sure that anti-doping isn't an undue burden, but it becomes, we protect that relationship and the positivity around what anti-doping and clean sport brings to athletes' careers and their legacies. So I hope to continue to be a big part of that and offer my expertise as well as collaborate with all our international colleagues on that task.
That's great. Well, thank you so much. Thank you so much to Allison, Matt, and USADA for bringing us together and doing this podcast. And I wish you all best success and continue work. And it's interesting to learn about the overlap between illicit drugs and drugs used for performance, the same type of cheating and testing. It's really fascinating.
Thanks so much for having us, Sweet. It's a pleasure.
Thank you.
Thank you for listening to High Truths on Drugs and Addiction, where you learn from experts from around the globe and around all aspects of drugs. This week's episode would not be possible without the generous support of our sponsor. A sincere and warm thank you to Drug Free America Foundation. Visit dfaf.org. And ISAC, the International Academy on the Science and Impact of Cannabis. That's IASIC1.org. High Truths producer is Dave Rivas from Davey Boy Productions. I'm your host, Dr. Onit Lev. We hope we brought your day a little bit more High Truths.